My name is Patsy Hogan with Heartland Cattle Company out of McCook, Nebraska, and I'm going to be your moderator for the session here this morning. We've got two outstanding speakers to address this topic this morning, folks. They're going to be talking about the Bud Williams way, if you will, about working livestock. These are a couple of folks that have embraced this concept and done a very nice job of it. So I think you're going to be in for a really nice session this morning. A couple of opening comments. First of all, I would like to thank Pfizer Animal Health for sponsoring Cattlemen's College. It's a wonderful opportunity that we all have each year at the NCBA convention to come have a day of education. And Pfizer's help behind this program is very necessary and very much appreciated. So we do appreciate that. The second thing I'd like to mention is this session is going to last until about 12:20. So we're going to be in here quite a while. Rather than take an organized break, what we'd like to do is invite you that if you need to get up, go out and get a cup of coffee, stretch your legs for just a minute or two, grab a donut or whatever, just feel free to go do that kind of on your own. We are terribly crowded in here today. And rather than take an organized break, we're going to kind of leave it up to you to manage yourselves as far as that's concerned. Okay, with that in mind, I'd like to get right into the session and introduce our two speakers today. We've got, we're very fortunate to have with us Drs. Tom Knopfinger and Lynn Locatelli out of Twin Core Family Clinic in Winkleman, Nebraska. These are some folks, this is two veterinarians that comes from a group of 10 working veterinarians from two practices that work together out of Oakley Vet Service in Oakley, Kansas, and Twin Core Vet Clinic out of Winkleman, Nebraska. These folks have taken a very innovative approach to their vet practice and are working together rather than working with their what would probably be their biggest competitors in the area, and they have implemented some very innovative practices between the two groups. I'd like to start with introducing Lynn Locatelli first. Lynn is a native of California. Excuse me. I've got quite a little bit of cough here. Graduated from UC Davis and has been with Twin Core Vet Clinic now for 11 years. She's been very involved in endpoint management of feedyard cattle with the use of ultrasound, and has also been very involved in low-stress cattle management, as well as low-stress management of horses using the Pirelli system. Lynn served on the Nebraska Vet Med Association Board of Directors, and has been instrumental in the continuing education portion of the Nebraska Vet Med Group in terms of evaluating young students that could get into the Vet Med program at Kansas State University through a cooperative arrangement between those two states. Our second speaker this morning is Dr. Tom Knopfinger, who is a native of Wright, Colorado, and got his education at Colorado State University. And Tom brings to us a wealth of experience, including serving on as past president of the Academy of Vet Consultants, and also was named the 2001 Consultant of the Year. Along with that, he received a Distinguished Service Award from the Nebraska Vet Med Association. But I think probably the thing that says the most about Tom, hold your hands up for the crowd, if you would. If you look at Tom's hands, he's got a classic pair of veterinarian hands. I think he's got about two or three broken knuckles. You can kind of tell he's been down there and working in it. And that probably says as much about Tom's background as we should know. With that, I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Lynn and Dr. Tom. I think you're in for a real treat this morning. Sit back, enjoy, and I'll try to step away from the mic so I don't ruin your ears, and we'll go from there. Thanks, folks.
Thank you very much, Patsy. We'd like to really express our appreciation to Pfizer and the NCBA for this opportunity to come and share with you what we've done as a work in progress in response to the time that we've got to work with Bud Williams, both from our, Bud came to our town and lived with us for 2 or 3 years, and prior to that and after that, we remained in close contact. It's important to us as veterinarians that we explain to you how we got introduced into Bud Williams' concepts, why as veterinarians we became interested in these ideas. We'd like to encourage you to understand the animals that give us so much back. We'd like for you to understand it more clearly. It is important to us that we let you at least know some of these concepts and you can take them home and start trying to work with them. There are some of you in the room that can do these things better than Dr. Lynn or I, and for those people, we welcome you and we want you to contribute to this discussion. Anytime you have an experience to share or a question or something you think is not quite right, please volunteer that information. And for those of you, we commend you and want to fortify how important what you're doing is to the animals and the people around you. For those of you that are not familiar with Bud Williams, you know, the first exposure I had to Bud was 8 or 10 years ago. I've been out doing some surgeries for an evening and got back in home. I was so excited about what we got to do that day. I couldn't sleep, so turned on the TV and there was a National Geographic special on there. And here's this man in his 60s walking 3,000 head of reindeer 26 miles across the Arctic and putting them in this tent so the Eskimos could harvest their antlers. And in the past, they'd have to have helicopters, snowmobiles, all those kinds of things, and the reindeer would go in there and tear the fence down and get away, and they just had it. And I was impressed by that. A year or two later, I saw another National Geographic special, and here he and his wife went up on the Aleutian Islands and gathered all the feral cattle that were placed there after World War II. And they trained these cattle, drove them across the swamps, across the old air base there, took them down to the beach, and the military back in these barges. These barges were sitting there and had these end gates down on the bank, and the tide sitting there. These animals volunteered to scamper up that slick end gate and crawl up in that boat without any fences or anything. Really impressed me how he understood what he was doing. But he spent a lot of time out in open grazing country, and then most recently he's been in Canada and managed a feed yard, a 7,000-10,000 head feed yard for the last 8 or 10 years. And he's brought that expertise. Now he's actually living in Bowie, Texas. We would like for you to understand how we have taken what he's helped us with and how we've applied it to our veterinary practice. We would like for you to take responsibility to teach your people that what they do, where they stand, and their body language, anytime they're next to these animals, they have the choice of making that interaction either positive, neutral, or negative. We want you to never, ever take for granted the power and the potential of the interaction between the handlers we have out there and the animals that we expect to give us our living. It's absolutely important that you understand that we challenge you to know that what each of these animals is doing, where he's standing, and what his response is to this predator is very easy to explain. You can, you know, I hope through time, what you understand is totally a work in progress. We'll learn more about understanding this interaction the rest of our lives. One of the main reasons that we got interested in these kinds of issues is to make things easier and more efficient. If you can imagine the difference between watching Danny Mortensen or Billy Empower ride a saddle bronc compared to what it would look like when I get on one of those things, think of the difference. We've asked people to go out there and take care of our animals. I think they felt a little bit like I would feel if I got on a saddle bronc. If you can teach them these things, they start to almost look like a Billy Empower. You know, when Danny Mortensen rides a bronc, it looks almost so easy they don't get any points. This is important that we have, that we understand that we can make these things very easy and efficient for our people. As a veterinarian, I'm a little bit ashamed of what our profession has offered you as an industry in areas of health progress. If we look at the NOM survey done 10 years ago, we lost 1% of the cattle in America's feed yards. The most recent survey, we lost 1.4%. Death loss in America's feed yards in the past 10 years has gone up 40%. And that's even in the presence of very, very good scientific research. Better new generation antibiotics. More important, more information on immunology, better generation vaccines. We're sitting there, we've got these tools, and the death loss trend is going the wrong way. As a veterinarian, driving through feed yards or cow calf ranches or backgrounding yards, if I saw a group of cattle that I thought was doing optimal, they were doing to their genetic potential, We just drive on by. But as I saw pens of cattle or pastures full of cattle or cowherds, the performance was not optimum. Really, what was in the back of my toolbox to offer you as a client was limited to vaccines, antibiotics, and trace mineral or nutritional information. Those three areas are very, very important and are critically important to management. But you and I know you've seen many groups of animals that were not performing to their optimum that did not need revaccinated. They did not need an antibiotic, and they did absolutely have nice mineral nutrition, macro mineral nutrient background, and there was probably no reason to mess with the formulation of the diet. There are lots of times when the low stress handling skill that we're going to talk about today can make a huge difference in these kinds of animals. What got me started on this is we used to process long haul calves, and at day 4 or 5 or 6, we'd go out there and here they are very depressed. And we'd ask our people to get those calves up and take them down and re-vac them with 7 cents worth of a straight IVR vaccine. And lo and behold, we couldn't believe how much better they looked the next morning. Now, I'm not an immunologist, but it's hard for me to give all the credit to that improved attitude, improved health, improved intake to the vaccine. We'll talk about what may have been the reason for this improved attitude and better performance of those kinds of cattle. The most important thing that Dr. Lynn and I have been able to achieve with the efforts that we've done has been the most exciting is what it's done to revitalize the human resources out there. We are a tiny, tiny fraternity, and we've asked some very inherently caring people to take care of millions of dollars of assets for us, and we've sent them out there to do something that's very important with almost either very poor training or no training. If we thought they could get a saddle on a horse and he could get it to stay on there and get on it, he was a pin rider. If we thought he could fill a syringe and read the treatment protocol, he became a doctor. That's not fair to these people. When you teach them the things that we're going to talk about today, it's absolutely amazing what it's done to the stability of the workforce within these operations, what it's done to the teamwork and the self-esteem of not only the animals, but the people. And this is the best thing that has absolutely happened. As we learn more about what we're talking about today, it's absolutely obvious that it has a very positive impact on the health, performance, and safety and harmony of not only the animals, but the people. And these types of things have become very common sense, low-cost, high-yield management tools. I think from the veterinary standpoint, the other thing that has become very, very evident to us is that there are many examples of field trials or research that tell us very, very clearly that when we do a lung lesion audit at slaughter, there is no correlation between the risk of a lung lesion and a treatment tag. I.e., if we say we're going to stand at the slaughterhouse and watch for lungs going by that have enough adhesions or consolidation or pathology to translate into 0.1 to a half a pound a day lost performance, that we would expect more of those lesions in the cattle that have been in the hospital. And in fact, that is not true. Dr. Lonnie Bryant has some really nice work at Great Plains Veterinary Education Center in Nebraska and wrote this up in 1999. They have really nice treatment records from birth to slaughter of a calf crop there in Nebraska. When they took all the calves that had been treated sometime in their life and did a lung lesion survey, 40% of those calves had some kind of pathology in their lung. When they went over and got the calves that had never been to the hospital, not 40% of those had lesions, but 42% of those had lesions in their lungs. Very obvious that a large number of that population had a very fairly serious episode go on in their chest, and the caretakers either could not identify that happening, or they saw it and chose to do nothing about it. In short, what I think we hope to help you understand today is that in a lot of operations, our current observation abilities do not allow accurate assessment of health. And in fact, some of the things we do will encourage cattle to hide their true state of health from us.
Dr. Tom, let's take a look at some visible consequences of improper cattle handling. And this slide depicts just a few conditions that we see directly related to poor cattle handling. Okay. On our left, we can see bruising. And bruising is real common and quite a problem. Particularly if bruising occurs towards the time of slaughter. And being so involved with implant management, you know, this is fairly common. And if it happens, and you're selling these cattle in the very next market, that treatment from the carcass falls out on the floor, and it's essentially the same as carving that out of your pocketbook. So it has a real direct effect on the bottom line. Not just negative for the cattle, but certainly translates into a lot of lots of dollars. Over here, we see bullers, and that's we're not going to touch on that in too much detail today, because certainly there are folks that believe bullers are strictly a man-made problem. So again, that's strictly attributable to handling in that sense. Fractures, it amazes me that people expect a fractured leg when they run cattle through a processing facility. I mean, that's certainly a poor expectation. And it's out there. There's folks that just expect that to happen when they process cattle. We need to elevate our expectations. That doesn't need to happen. We'll show some footage here in a second that depicts cattle with collapse, that's an assault separation. We see that fairly commonly in our feedlot practice. So as you can see right there, the stall has been abraded all the way down to the quick, if you will. You see that little blurred line there? That lets the organisms migrate up the leg and build infection. If that infection extends into a joint, we've lost our animal. So we think it's insane to lose our animal because we don't recognize simply how sensitive the cattle are and adjust our handling to that. So we'll run the footage. Cattle, there's soul separation, and there's whole abscesses. This has a really negative effect on performance. The last thing they want to do is eat and drink. We see the visible effects in the lame cattle, but there's certainly a large subpopulation, if you will, of cattle that are affected that don't demonstrate the lameness quite as well as these do. There's certainly a negative impact on performance there. You need to focus on performance. Optimize performance. Create good health. We'll talk about how cattle like to hide their weaknesses later. These cattle aren't doing anything to hide their weaknesses because they're in a great degree of discomfort and pain. This is an abscess in the drain. If you don't drain them, the infection extends into the joint. If you do drain them, it's very labor intensive. Those are pretty easy to see. These are consequences that aren't so easily seen that exist in a big way. Certainly not eaters, poor performance is a big one. Dr. Tom will tell you a story about Goldie a little bit later in the presentation. But what she needed was some good care and good handling, not antibiotics. Certainly poor cattle handling impacts carcass quality in a negative way, such as our gut feathers that we see here. Certainly it has a negative impact on marbling. And again, if you sell in a value-based market, that's very detrimental to the bottom line. And certainly immune dysfunction. When we receive cattle in feedlots, or when feedlots receive cattle, they all have tinsel in what they expect in terms of morbidity and mortality. Again, let me encourage you to focus on performance and health. The cattle in Arizona probably do pretty well on sunshine, a little bit of water, and some rocks. Same in Nevada. Cattle also thrive in the humid, insect-infested environments of the southeast. In the northern plains, they do very well in very cold and Schneider conditions. Yet we put it in a feed yard, offering the best quality feed available, usually as much as they want. They don't have to travel for it, and they die. We cancel it with more salary. That's insane when you think of where they've come from and what they can endure. So there's more keeping cattle healthy than just providing good nutrition, good vaccines, and some antibiotics. So hopefully we'll illustrate that very clearly.
Being a veterinarian, we have to talk about sickness. I think the point we want to make with that slide is that the animals that we work with have a lot of resistance. And that the disease-causing organisms that cause this are always in their system. Those are not organisms that come flying in on a prevailing wind or get dropped out of a helicopter by a veterinarian. They are within the cattle. The point we want to make is that, you know, it took 20 years until folks talked to us to prove that Pasteurella caused the chicken fever. Because a long time ago, they would take Pasteurella out of, get it out of the head pile, put it in a normal healthy calf, and the calf would laugh at it. They had to decide that it took lots of stress, and IBR, and DVD, and a combination of dehydration, and anxiety, and fear to create this. This sick calf took a lot of effort to create. We had to take him away from his mother. We had to get him cold and dehydrated and wet and scared and put him someplace where he wouldn't eat for 3 or 4 days and then maybe process him and bruise him up, and then this happens. Stress is tremendously important in how the interaction happens between the pathogens that are right there and the animal. We would like, and all these things are multiples of each other. They're accumulative. This is just a drawing to help me understand this more from a book in First Kent. The thing that I think we will learn the rest of our lives is, what is the definition of normal animals? How do they carry their head? How do they eat? How do they interact with animals? We've got to teach our people that first. And we've got to become very, very aware of the variation in normals between Solera cattle and Hereford cattle. The difference of normalcy between a Holstein and an Angus. But I think, well, the other thing, once we know what normal is, then at the first recognition that cattle are moving from normal to apprehension, that when we see early signs of apprehension in animals, we address that. But we do not let apprehension turn into anxiety. And that we don't ignore anxiety until it turns into the panic of wheat and chaff running around the pen for 3 days. We know that stress is going to impact both these animals. What is amazing to us is what will stress these cattle won't even notice. And it's what impacts animals is on a very individual basis. Each of these animals is an individual, and each of these groups of animals are an individual. And our handlers become very intrigued about that. And that meeting and working with these two different animals is just as exciting as going out here and meeting each other. The thing that we think is very important is we're going to ask the ultimate predator to take care of the ultimate prey animal, that we need to understand a little more about that relationship. So we've got this two-legged thing with the eyes in front of his face taking care of a very docile prey animal. What happens there? In order for us to understand what happens, we would like for you to understand very basic predator-prey relationships. And we would like you to understand the prey animal instincts. The most powerful one is that these animals know that they have to conceal weakness to survive. These animals know that a predator is lazy, and the predator will never, ever pick on the fastest, strongest, healthiest, smartest animal in the herd. He will pick on the depressed, the lame, the old, the hungry first. So, if this animal thinks that a predator is approaching him, he will hide lameness, illness, depression, age for as long as he can, right up until he dies. best example of this is we bought one kid from South Dakota 2 or 3 years ago when it used to snow where I live. The truck got stranded on the Nebraska Dakota border, and we came in there an extra 12 hours. When the truck backed up to where I live, you could see there was a lot of blood on the side of the trailer. The kid had gotten up, laid down. And one of those little guys had stuck his foot out the side of that one of the trailer. He pushed that out there and actually cut his toe off, and there that little toe was frozen beside the truck. The trucker said, "We've got to identify that animal, documents that he was on here, so I can visit with our insurance people." Well, that'd take a minute. We unloaded the calves, little bunch of Lenny Angus Cross calves under the yard line. The snow was about this deep. Thought it would take 2 minutes to pick out which one he is. Those calves went around there. There was not a single animal in that load of Lenny. The only way we could find him is we let him spring out and slow down. And he was the one leaving blood tracks from the snow. He was so sure that what was around him was a predator, that he was willing to put 100% of his weight on a foot that had one toe removed. We got him and took him and a friend in a stall, bandaged the foot, put him in out of the weather, and you know what he acted like the next morning. He no more put that foot down on the ground and he could fly. The point is, this instinct to conceal weakness is the most powerful prey animal instinct there is. The other thing that's terribly important is to know that these animals love to be together. Herd mentality is so important. Take one away from the herd, it's a stress on not only him, but it's a stress on the other animals that like his company. If you're gathered, how many times you see people gather cattle and get close to the gate and a single one takes off over the hill and somebody actually chases him? There's a festivity. All you have to do is not interfere with him coming back. He can't stand to be out there by himself over 2 seconds. If you get out of the way, he's coming back, he'll come running back. This is very important to understand. These are flight or fight. Confinement is threatening. With Dr. Lynn and I will talk about confinement anxiety. This is a beautiful helper when these animals can interact. These animals know that they have 800 acres here and they can get away from this guy if they need to. So they're having fun. They're visiting them. And this is a beautiful tool out in a field or a pasture or in a large pen. But you put this animal in an alleyway and have this thing standing there, whether he's biting him, whether he's just looking at him. That's like you and I being in a shark cage and having not being able to get out of there and having sharks standing right there. I would wet my britches. This is terrible when this animal is confined. What Dr. Lynn and I will talk about, and we still don't know this deeply enough, but these animals are so much more aware of what's going on than we are. That's just absolutely amazing. They can see, hear, feel, smell, anticipate things that we don't even know. You all know about what animals are aware of. My dog comes in and touches me 10 seconds before my alarm goes off every morning. No matter whether I get up at 2 a.m. or 6 a.m., she hates that damn alarm clock. Something tells her when that thing's going to go off. It never gets to go off because she asks me to shut it off. I don't know. They do amazing things.
If we approach cattle very directly, very straight line, we march in there on a mission, like to get cattle out of the pen, that is oftentimes very threatening. But seldom is our intent. That is often what the cattle perceive our approach. We back up and start to fine tune our powers of observation. We learn a lot more about how to fine-tune our skills and build our skills for the low-stress handling. We tend to like to get behind things and push and creep around. That's shocking behavior. That's what predators do in the wild. That's what cattle also perceive. And again, we're required to do that and be aware of that. Vocalization creates fear. There's some folks that believe when you holler at cattle, it has the same effect as a big walking dose of steroids. And for those of us in the veterinary profession, we know how detrimental a big walking dose of steroids can be. So, good stockmen are very quiet. And there's a real high efficiency of motion when you watch good stock handlers work. Cattle are not a verbally based species. Good stock handlers use their body language to move cattle. Every time a good stock handler moves, it has meaning to the cattle. And Bud's working very hard on teaching these concepts. But if you back up and observe the good handlers, every move they make means something to the cattle. We have to work really hard to override our instincts. If we work just a little bit and understand just a little bit about how prey animals communicate with each other, and if we learn to emulate their ways of communication, we really get those cattle to work for us very effectively. I have a little bit more footage of a dog working here. And this is a real successful interaction. You certainly have to desensitize the cattle to the dogs. The dogs have to learn how to work with the cattle. All the footage that we'll show you today that has a dog involved in it has a dog that hasn't been trained. To get good lines of dogs, they're hardwired to do their job correctly. It's nice to watch this dog work. He's got really good rates. So he'll get the cattle moving and cut it back off. Now these dogs work really well, and they're cattle dogs because they know when to drive and they know when not to drive. They know that usually better than people. One of the hardest things for people to learn is how and when to release pressure. But you saw the dog right there moving the cattle along, and then he kind of stopped. He didn't just dive in there and scare him. And so he's effective with keeping his bunch together. Learning how these prey animals communicate is the best foundation for developing success with low stress handling. Okay, so if we understand the interaction, if we understand what we can do that causes harm, we can stop doing that. We can understand what the prey animals use to communicate. We can start doing that. We can create success. And the animals want to work for us. They want the leadership. This is kind of a landmark. And this is the landmark slide in that it really goes against what we've heard contemporary facilities, how contemporary facilities should be designed. The cattle need to see what is pressuring them, and they need to see where to go. If they're afraid that something might come up and eat them, might come up and hurt them, might come up and separate them from their friends, that is not very comforting. It doesn't make them very willing to work for us. But if they can see where the pressure is from, and they can see when the pressure is asking them to go, it's a much more efficient system. And we'll demonstrate this in our processing facility a little bit later. On the way down here, Dr. Palmer talked about probably defining pressure. Pressure is used in a lot of senses, and really the cattle are what defines pressure. Everything we do has to be in reference to how the cattle respond to us. So pressure for one set of animals might be just one step of the handler moving towards them. that might be a lot of pressure in some cells, particularly the cerebral cell that we had up here earlier. Sometimes just turning your body or turning your head is enough body language to create pressure. And you know it's pressure, the cattle tell you by responding somehow. Usually their head comes up, maybe the eye comes to look at the handler, but the cattle respond. That's how that pressure kind of definition works. It's always relative to the cattle, and it can be many things. A gate can be a pressure. When you drive cattle up to a gate, going through that gate might be a great deal of pressure. So anything that causes the cattle to respond is pressure. Pressure is a motivator. We use pressure to ask cattle to move or to work for us. We need to release pressure to reward the positive response. And being hardwired as a predator, we aren't hardwired at all to release pressure. So that's something that we have to work on pretty well. And releasing pressure, again, can just be backing up to that. We'll show footage that shows how some of the big handlers do release pressure. But that's what tells the cattle that they're doing what we'd like them to do. And for those that do follow the corralling system, what they say is the horse learns when you quit doing what you're doing. It's the same thing. If you use pressure as your motivator with cattle and never release it, they never understand how to work for you. The release of pressure is really the trainer. Cattle are easily trained if you observe how they respond to your body language or to your actions. Cattle like to be trained. Cattle like leaders. When they have a leader to guide them somewhere, it erases confusion. Cattle don't like confusion, neither do people. You know, when you hear things like cattle are afraid of shadows, they're afraid of obstacles, they're afraid of things hanging in conflict environments. And if you remember the slide that we showed earlier about the environments that cattle come from, it's kind of hard to believe that they're afraid of everything. We don't do any dairy work in our practice, but we learn to do the dairy to see how the cattle are trained and how they maneuver through the systems. And it's really quite remarkable what dairy cows can do. They perform very well in confinement. They perform very well when there's a lot of people, a lot of machinery, and a lot of noise around. So they've been taught to do this somehow. And certainly the basic principles of this are removing negative stimuli. The biggest one being a bad attitude. Dr. Tom said earlier, cattle are sensitive. Cattle are very sensitive. They know when we're having a bad day before we know we're having a bad day. We need to work. I'm either a good note or a lighthearted kind of emotion or be devoid of emotion. Anything negative tends to create big problems. Certainly, desensitizing cattle to unfamiliar processes is one thing that works very well. For folks that understand horses, sensitizing horses to what you want them to do and desensitizing horses to things that scare them or things that are new is a real basic principle of training. There is a parallel with cattle as well. We'll just learn some dairy things very quick. I don't know how many dairy people we have in here, but this is kind of a massive parlor, a pair of bone parlor. And the cow is just marching here, and it's a normal sequence in their lives.
The whole idea that you can train cattle to do things was new to our practice. We don't have any problem accepting the idea that we can train a dog to sit or fetch or lay down and put in, but we get a horse to slide and do a rollback. I never really thought about asking these animals to do something. Why would you expect these animals to do this unless you ask them and talk a little bit? If you have a set of weaning calves, get out, break out of your weaning corral, and you have a set of horses in the pen, you're going to go after those calves. You don't go out and get all the 2-year-olds and go after them. You usually try to find something that's been ridden first or before that you would take you after those calves. Training is important to these animals, just as important as it is to horses. I think Dr. Lamb has got a couple of things that I think you should take home with you. And that is that cattle love to see what is pressuring them, and they love to see where they can go. And then we need to override our instincts and take advantage of that idea. A good example of that is if my job is, let's just imagine that you are all cattle, and my job is to come in this alleyway over here and ask all of you cattle to go out through that door there. What most of us would do, we'd come in either a foot or a horseback or a 4-wheeler, and we'd drive right around here and we'd get behind all of you and see if we could shove a couple hundred thousand pounds of cattle out of that hole. And that's our instinct. That's what a lot of people would try to do. It's a lot more effective to come in this room and work with 3 or 4 of you here and get some motion started. And if I can get 3 or 4 of you to go out there, all I have to do is back out of the way and let the herd mentality kick in, and you will all follow those 5 cattle out. If that doesn't work, then I can show you how to go in the back of that. And then I will ask you all to go back against that wall, and I'll put gentle pressure on you, and you won't like that for over a minute or two. And pretty soon, the most sensitive one of you will want to get away from me, and you'll go down that wall, and you'll go out that place. And I will stay out here where you can see me, and I'll encourage the rest of you to go out there. And I will try never, ever to be behind you. These are things that I want you to think about. Go ahead.
Use the bait. Like hay, grain.
That's a good idea. Except I might be somewhere sometime that I don't have bait with me. I think that it's important that if you take responsibility and you're standing in a pit of cattle, and the cattle don't go where you want them to go, don't do what you want them to do, you haven't asked them correctly. They're doing exactly what you're telling them to do. If the cattle in the feed yard go to the wrong pen, and the gate's over here, and they go down to that pen, they went there because of what you and your handlers are doing. Remember when cattle would be doing something we didn't like what they were doing, we'd say to each other, be still, be quiet, don't move? That drives them crazy. Body language is important. Sir, never ever go to a pen of cattle and stand like a post. Try that sometime. And notice how big the circle is around you. That is a clear message to those cattle that you're a predator. There is no, all predators, if you have made a bird dog pointing at a quail, a mountain lion getting ready to jump on an antelope, they're rigid, they're fixed, they never move. There is no predator that goes like this. So, go to a pen, stand like post, see how big the circle is, go do something else, come back to that same pen, stand in the same place, and move no more than this. And watch those cattle come to you. That's how aware they are of your body language. Some of the techniques, you have to be able to create movement to guide it. So, if you're going to create a movement or motion in a group of animals, don't work and never ever be behind them. Those are subordinate, stupid animals. They don't have very responsive. Work up here at the leaders. These animals are the flying, goofy animals that the leaders have pushed out in front of them. So you go up to this part of the herd and you pressure at an angle that will create motion. And you never know what that angle is. But if you go in here and you don't get what you like, you back up until you're out of their flight zone. You go this way. So the point is, if you're going to get a group of animals, you look for the initiators, the instigators, you work with the leaders. You stretch the proper angle, and when you get motion, you tell those animals thank you by stepping back and relieving pressure. Whether it's one animal or a single one, if you say hello to this animal, you move toward him and he moves his head, just say thank you. Back up and stay one. Then he'll let you get twice as close to him. Now he moves his head or his front leg, same thing. Just rock back on your foot, and he'll take a step or two, and he'll turn around, and he'll look at you, and he'll lock into you. You will create a focus between he and you that is stronger than the focus between he and his pinmates. When you get him, when he goes off in his tent, every time he stops, he'll look back at you for guidance. You cannot expect him to do anything, the herd or the individual animal, to do anything for you until you've said hello and created this focus. Very, very important. So you're looking for focus, communication, and look at the look for a proper angle. Okay,
these are some real basic concepts to understand, and they'll reoccur. There'll be a recurring theme in this presentation. But basically, you want to walk with the motion of the cow to slow it down. This works well in a feedlot pen, this works well out with grazing cattle. That's a really basic concept to understand, and it can work for you, it can work against you. Just understand that when you walk parallel with cattle movement, it can slow it down. You walk against cattle movement to speed it up. Again, it can work for you or against you. Just be aware that you're doing it. Dr. Tom talked about adjusting your angle of pressure according to how the cow responds. We'll talk about that a little bit more as the schematic keep popping up through the presentation. But the cow will always tell you where to be. Again, the cow aren't wrong. They're doing what you ask. So if you want to redirect them, you need to change your angle and your technique of pressure. What we'd like to do is maintain a constant flow of cattle movement. Now, we talked about releasing pressure, but keep your cattle flow constant. That's the quickest way to work cattle. Creating processing facility is to keep the flow constant. Whenever we have starts and stops, that ruins the time. We might want to work fast, but the harder we drive, the slower the cattle end up going through the facility. So constant flow of cattle is where our goal is. Talk a little bit about the technique that people do to create the skin, and it's usually inadvertent pressure from the back of the herd. If you go to feedlot, if you have the opportunity to go to feedlot, like we do, and there's several of them, when you watch people right into pen, they just generally march into a pen, go to the back of the herd, and push real hard. When you do that, you can gain the blind spot, check pressure, check all cattle and see the pressure, or the feel threat of a predator. And that's when you start getting that egg beater, that circling motion. We hear from different publications that cattle want to circle. Well, when you're observing your cattle, are they just out there circling in the pasture, circling the pen? It's generally something that we create, not something that they want to do. And oftentimes, this is how we get them to do it. So be aware of that.
One of the things that has really rewarded us is to understand, first of all, that body language and presence of humans has huge effects on these animals. What absolutely has been intriguing to us is how impressionable young animals are. If you stop and think about it, you can teach a child 3 years old to swim in 20 minutes. But if somebody my age, it would take 3 years to teach them to swim. It's just amazing how sensitive and receptive young animals are. So your responsibility is to understand that training these baby calves starts at your first exposure of you to them. The relationship between you and that mother are very, very important. So how you tag a calf, how you treat a sick baby, how you catch a newborn is terribly important. You all know that we have clients that can, we have people that can catch a baby calf that's newborn, put something on its navel, maybe vaccinate it, put a tag in its ear, weigh it, and when they get ready to leave, the calf will almost follow that person. They've had such a good time. We have other people who go out there and tag these babies, and the mother's up in the back of the pickup with these people, and it's just an absolute. The calf is bawling, it's crying, it's a little difference. And it's